Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here with you. This is the show that answers your questions on cricket, if you've asked them, in a format that we have previously discussed. The best formats, of course, are for you to contact us on Patreon. Go to the Good Areas Podcast Network or Good Areas Live, whatever it is. I should know the name of our Patreon. It's Good Areas something. And you can sign up there for the first class and above membership, and that allows you to ask questions on this show. Separate to that, if you can hang around when we're live, you can always do a YouTube super chat. That one's a bit more flaky because even we don't know when we're recording. I think this show has been put up for about five different times today. So there you go. But first question is about Kane Williamson. And Ian says, if he's English or Australian, how close does Kane get to Joe Root's run tally in Test cricket? Oh, what is Root? Root is at 13,952. Okay. We can work this out mathematically, can't we? So if he has scored 13,952 runs in 164 matches, that is 85 runs a game. I think Kane Williamson's at like 84 runs a game, I want to say. So he's played longer in international cricket than, where is he? 9,515. Yeah, he's played longer. He's played 2 years longer. So he'd be at what, 180, 185? Let's give him some, because he's a bit more injury prone than Root is. So, you know, I say Root's played 164. I say 175. So he has 9,515. And he's at 110 matches. Why can't I find Williamson on here? I just had him. 110, just trust myself, really. So that's 86.4. So he's had more runs per game. So he probably started 2 years earlier. But does he start 2 years earlier if he plays for England? It's a pretty strong team. Probably does it. So we take that back. Yeah, I think I would have him about the same as Root. 2 runs more a game is the best way of looking at it. So I suppose it just depends on injuries and which one of them was ready first. I'm trying to remember what Kane's early... I know he started a little bit slow because he was so young. What is he now? God, he's only 35. Him and Martin Crowe could have batted forever if their bodies had just been... played the game with them. So, yeah, probably not quite good enough in his first 3 years of Test cricket to get into the side consistently. And then from 2013 onwards, obviously, just world-class from then on in. Very, very good for a very, very long time. He's very good at cricket, Kane Williamson, or he used to be. Hayden says, do you think Brendan McCullum will get another international coaching job once his time with England is up? I don't think that's the question, Hayden. The question is, would he want another international coaching job? McCullum's a really interesting person because I don't know how many people know this, but he was one of the New Zealand players who was sort of moving on from international cricket when the IPL first came in. There was a lot of them, they were certainly putting the IPL ahead of the national team. Then McCullum got the captaincy job, and he was one of the reasons that they sort of swung back to being like, no, when we play for New Zealand, we have to do this. We still want to be able to play whenever we want, and, you know, we want there to be more flexibility than there has been, you know, historically, and all of these sorts of things. But we are in a situation where we really do think at the moment we can put a special team together. And he was right. Three World Cup finals and the World Test Championship come after that conversation, right? So he nailed it. And they weren't particularly good coming into that point either. So he does like international cricket, I suppose is the point I'm making. Other than coaching India, I don't think there's another job that will pay him what he would want to be paid though. And that's where there's a big change. I also think that there are probably some, like Gautam Gambhir is a really good example of this. I'm trying to think of someone else. I think there are some coaches who are like, the ultimate challenge is still international cricket, and I can make a bigger mark there than I can being a good IPL coach, which is probably still true. May not be true in 15 years' time, but certainly still true now. I don't think McCullum would think that way anymore. Crate says, Sobers was the better batter and arguably the better bowler compared to Callis. However, In a flat pitch era, Callis was used as a fifth bowler, while Sobers did much more of the groundwork at a higher average. Callis also batted more of his career higher up the order. Could it be argued that South Africa used Callis a lot better than the Windies used Sobers? How would you have used either of them to get the most out of them? Yeah, we actually have a piece eventually that is, it's not really about Callis versus Sobers, although one day we might just do an entire piece on that because I think it's a great argument to have. It's probably worth throwing in Keith Miller as well and Imran Khan. All four of them. I think those are the more. I think those are the four most fascinating all rounders. I think Imran and Miller don't get as much credit because they're bowlers first and not batters first. Anyway, all those four guys very good at cricket. Imran the only one not a great fielder, perhaps. So Sobers has a much higher bowling average, but one of the reasons he has a much higher bowling average is, I think I'm right in saying he bowls more overs per game than Jimmy Anderson. And he does that when he wasn't always even a frontline bowler. So he does become a frontline bowler, but when he began his career, he was more used as their second spinner or their, I want to say Moeen Ali spinner. Yeah, maybe that's sort of the way he's used. If you know, you want to get your wickets with the quicks, but then you want to try your spinner a little bit, but maybe like a defensive version of Moeen Ali. I'm trying to think of a team that, it's not quite like a Paul Harris role because he's a stock bowler. But knowing that you have someone who can bowl spin, who can come in for you at that stage on a wicket that has pace. I've over-explained this now, but you get my point. I think that if you took out the spin bowling and you just had Sobers as a fast bowler, his bowling average would be a lot better than Callis's. I don't think there's any doubt that he was a genuine, at the very least, replacement level opening bowler. I think he was a better bowler than Callis from stories. The only one difference I would say is that Callis was pretty much a good bowler all of his career until he got very late and obviously stops bowling. And Sobers does it. Anyway, there is a piece about that eventually. Callis bats higher up in the order, as you say. Could it be argued that South Africa used Callis a lot better than the West Indies? I think by the time we got to that period of cricket, and I don't think South Africa used all their all-rounders very well, but I think in their mind they were like, we have a guy who's going to play for 15 to 20 years and is probably going to be one of the best bats in the world. His bowling should be fifth bowler, right? And low usage fifth bowler. I think he's at about 20 overs a game, which is not terribly low use, but you know, it's not like he's at 25, 26, 27, right? Like, it's clear to me that they thought about that a lot. I do also wonder if it's because of the way he bowled. So if you think about Callis compared to Sobers, Sobers is going to get the new ball because he's a left arm swing bowler, obviously really good with a new ball. And then obviously when the pitch flattens out or the ball gets soft, you're going to throw the ball back to Sobers because he's now bowling finger spin or wrist spin. Whereas with Callis, it kind of makes sense for him to bowl that one spell. So it feels like you've got four really good fast bowlers for the first 20, 25 overs. And then you bring him back on for that sort of defensive spell later on, you know, after the 60 over mark for, you know, four to five overs. And what other times would you use him? All right. The only other time you're using him is when the ball is swinging because, you know, very good swing bowler. So I think Sobers has more use, which is one of the reasons, even though he has a higher bowling average, although some of that is because of the pitches that they both played on and everything else. I think Callis probably fit more into that. Whereas I think England have always tried to use I've always tried to use Stokes in that sort of Callis role, but it doesn't quite fit quite the same because he's actually at his best when the pitch is flat and you need someone to do something different. So what you really should use Stokes for is that one spell at the, you know, between the 15 and the 25 over mark. So you push his back even a little bit later than Callis, especially in England. But you want to be able to use him between 30 and 50 overs quite a bit. So you end up, it just means that Callis was perfectly suited to that. Whereas how do you do that with Sobers? You either don't use his spin at all, which seems like a waste, right? And then you go about it from that perspective. The batting order thing I think is really interesting, but I don't think you can be a genuine frontline bowler and bat at four. And I don't think Callis was ever used like a genuine frontline bowler, maybe for a couple of games, but not consistently. Whereas Sobers was 100% used as a frontline bowler, and not just a frontline bowler, but a heavy usage frontline bowler. So I think if you do that, I think you just have to be honest. I mean, Australia used Keith Miller at five as well. I don't think he batted at six. I don't think he batted at four. Where are we here? Let me just look at his, because he's a more interesting one to compare to Sobers from that perspective. God, he batted at three, 10 times. What a freakish athlete. Yeah, his best position is five. And I think if he comes in again, Miller, you'd probably bat him at six. And he comes just before Sobers. So perhaps that is part of the reason the West Indies moved Sobers down a little bit. One of the big fascinating things about Test all-rounders is they give you 12 players when you would normally have 11. And so you overuse them. But when you overuse them, they obviously have limitations because they're not specialist players. But also you can tie them out. So how you use them at their best, I think, it's a tricky situation. Like Keith Miller, let me just look, what was his first class record? Keith Miller averages 49 in first class cricket, right? You can't bat him at number six or seven, really. And the same with Callum, same with Sobers. Like if there's no normal situation where a player that has made, and Miller made 41 first class hundreds at almost 50 while attacking. There's no way that you would ever play a player like you want to keep them down. You probably want them at five, right? If not three or four. And so, but at the same time, Miller is genuinely a fast bowler of his era. He's taking the new ball. So I think in Miller's case and in Sobers' case, we're kind of trying to work out the best way to use these guys. But you even see it later on with like, let me look at Kapil Dev. It's fascinating the way we use all-rounders because, you know, we've talked about this a lot of like players being used in the wrong position when they're really talented. But sometimes the opposite happens and they get used too much. So if we look at Kapil Dev, I don't want the bowler, I want the batter. So he averages 31, right? And for me, that's a world-class number seven, especially in his era. But he bats almost as much at number eight. Now, there are other all-rounders. There are other reasons why that happens. But Kapil Dev batting at number seven is a transformative player for your team. You get an extra bowler in every single side, and you get a really attacking number seven. Number eight, it doesn't give you that flexibility in the same way. So Callis comes after Dev. And I think we're, by that stage in the 90s, we had a bit more of an idea of how to use all-rounders, but you can still argue that some of it is just the way Callis played. Reece says, with Williamson retiring this week, do you have plans for what you will produce content-wise already written down for when these greats retire and leave, or do you just simply react to the news and create content from there? That's a very good question, Reece. Sometimes you can kind of tell when a player is going to retire, or you might get a little steer from someone in the camp going, not sure he'll be around that much longer. And it's maybe not always enough to report on, but, you know, it gives you a bit of an idea. So Michael Clarke, I want to get this right. Ben Horne. Michael Clarke, I'm pretty sure Ben Horne was writing Michael Clarke's book. You'd have to go and check that, but this is how I remember it. 2015 Ashes, was it? And we had heard from Ben that Clarke was going to retire in 24 hours, but, you know, so it allowed everyone to prepare for it. And so I released a piece like an hour after he retired, and everyone was like, I can't believe you've written this piece, but it was actually 25 hours after I knew. There have been other situations where I've had that. On Williamson, I didn't have anything at all. I was actually in the middle. So the Williamson pieces come out today, Reece. What's today? Tuesday at 2 p.m. So it probably came out a few hours ago. The Williamson piece, I actually was in the middle of writing a big feature on Ben Stokes, and then Williamson retired. So I had to completely pivot, but I was kind of already in that big sort of sweeping epic narrative scape in my head. And I went back to Art of Batting. I had a look at one or two things I'd written about him before. And I was like, I think I know what I want to do. But it was very, very rushed. I've become an expert on doing those pieces over the years. If you look at, that's what I was known for at Crick Info as much as anything. And so I'm very good at having 24 hours to turn that around. This one took me about 36 hours because we were away in the middle of it. I still wrote some of it while we were away, but in a hotel in Essex, while my kids were asleep, I belted out the end of it. But I don't really have that. It's the sort of thing that I kind of feel I don't think you want to write beforehand. I think what you probably want to do is maybe have a bit more of a plan of maybe what I want to say about them. But I think for other writers, that takes a little bit longer. That doesn't take me that long, that part of it. And I would prefer to write this kind of piece on the adrenaline and the energy of them having just retired. Having said that, as a video creator, I really should have some of these pieces kind of around beforehand. I should have a big piece for when Virat finally retires, right? I should have a big piece for, you know, Rohit. Who else is Steve Smith, all these sorts of guys. At least the structural part of it as a draft. It's funny because I have a Sobers piece. And one of the reasons we have that Sobers piece that we talked about a moment ago, which is why I went into such depth on it, is because we heard a rumor that he wasn't doing too well health-wise. And I wasn't around in cricket writing when Bradman died. Imran Khan is still with us. You know, there aren't that many guys who are, you know, Shane Warne was a really tough one. When Shane Warne died, like, I was about to work on this big piece on Shane Warne and suddenly he died and, like, we had to rush out pieces. I think for those guys, I'd rather do something else. But I like the idea of Williamson has, I think that's one of my great skills, is the ability to pull things together really, really quickly. If it was more of a content machine, which we're not quite at, maybe we would have some plans for some of those people. But yeah, I think there's something, maybe because I used to write these pieces at games while things were happening. The energy of it is what makes me kind of tick at times. Ajit says, you've often said that Dale Steyn was probably the best flat pitch bowler of his time. What does that mean? And is there a similar thing for spinners? So everyone's good with a new ball, Ajit. Even bowlers who are not good with a new ball are kind of still good with the new ball. It's most first class cricketers are picked on the back of how they operate with the new ball, and it's you can find maybe six or seven guys in any cricket team in the world who can probably bowl from 0 to 15 overs or 15 to 25 if you're in England, right? Those sort of the overs when the ball's doing the most. What separates a bowler from that is what they do with the older ball. So I've argued this before, Glenn McGrath might be the best new ball bowler we've ever seen, but he also might be top 10 older ball bowler, despite the fact he didn't look like he should be. And so that period between overs 20 and 80 outside of England, because England's slightly different because of the Duke's ball here, but traditionally everywhere else is kind of where you see the hard bowling. Specifically in Australia, quite a lot in the subcontinent as well. If you're a seam bowler, the ball has got a little bit soft. The ball has stopped deviating. It's now just down to what you can do to upset the rhythm of the batter. And I think that Dale Steyn, because of the way his bouncer skidded, the fact that he would swing the ball, he was a proper swing bowler. So even if the ball went a little bit soft, he still had the ability to get some deviation. The fact that he could also bowl reverse swing and he could just blow through you with pace and he was accurate enough that you couldn't punish him even on a very flat pitch makes him an ideal kind of older ball bowler. It's slightly different for spinners. I suppose what you would say in spinners is who's the guy that can kind of shut down an end, right? And keep the pressure on. Which obviously Warne did, you know, really, really well. Murali, Kumble, like most of the great spinners did that. Whereas then you might have another spinner like, let's say Jack Leach. I know he's not on their level, but Jack Leach is someone who is a world-class spinner when the pitch is spinning. Not all spinners are, right? Like he is uniquely set up for a spinning surface. When the pitch is flat, Jack Leach really doesn't have much that he can keep you under pressure. Whereas you compare him to Rangana Harath, which is unfair on Leach, but if you compare him to Rangana Harath and you watch Harath bowl on flat wickets when there's no spin, right? He then starts to find other ways, and Bisham Bedi was a genius at this as well. They then find other ways to be able to lull you, you know, different speeds, different trajectories, different angles on the crease and everything else without losing their line and length. Mob says, if the answer is Kane, what is the question? Who is New Zealand's second greatest cricketer? Yeah, I'm pretty happy with him being that. Maybe not the second most important. Maybe Martin Crowe still has that thing, but I think he's certainly the New Zealand's second greatest cricketer. I also think going, you know, in the long run, being part of the Fab Four. I think the Fab Four is something that will last a long time in the way that the three W's did, right? For whatever reason, it has captivated people and it's, you know, memeized or whatever, however you want to think about it. It's created a brain worm in our heads. So I think that's also another really important one. And that's probably, you know, for me, those are the two things. And I think what I said in the feature was kind of the continuation of New Zealand cricket. Is the other big one, right? Like, I think they were building to what they built towards now, having looked at everything I've looked at and having covered them for 20 years and done the history lessons and talked to Jeremy and all these sorts of things and Martin and, you know, Ross and all these different people I've talked to about this journey, Flem. I think there's an element if it was coming, but also you kind of need to be the right man at the right time. And I think he was absolutely the right man at the right time for New Zealand. It's probably just a shame he didn't win a second title, right? Because he could have won two titles for them. Josh says, is there a case that opening batters are underappreciated in the art of batting top 50? Out of a team's five specialist batters, two are openers, but only 12 openers made the top 50, and only seven of 41 post-World War II picks were openers. Applying the same argument for first change bowlers, is there a case that Ben Stokes is in fact a top 50 bowler of all time? So, Josh, we were really worried about this during the book. I actually think we're much higher on openers than anyone else who's ever done that list before is. Our original data, when we just, like, we did a data dump to see where everyone came out, the openers were so low that we did two things at that stage. We lowered the average that we would look at for openers. So the original number was like, I think it was 44 for all batters. We lowered it to 42 for openers. And then we weighed in opening in the metric as the hardest job to bump people up. We still couldn't get that many more openers in. Look, I think who are the ones that are obvious I've missed out? So Gooch, Warner, Simpson. Laurie's in the book, isn't he? So is Laurie? I don't think Laurie made it either, did he? Can't remember. Those are the four off the top of my head. I'm trying to think. Oh, the Pakistani guy from the 90s, whose name I've just forgotten. We just didn't feel like he played enough tests. So there's five more off the top of my head. Sehwag's in, Gavaskar's in. There weren't really any New Zealand openers. Yeah. Desmond Haynes' record doesn't really stand up when you dissect it. There's a couple more Australians, isn't there, as well, I think. Even Langer, just as an opener, his record was incredible, but that's at his prime, so, you know. Langer's not that close to the book because of his overall career, but as an opener, I remember looking at that and going, yeah. When it comes down to it, we kind of tried everything we could. I think that if you look at the history of cricket, what you'll find, Josh, is that the best batters have generally been number threes and number fours. And so what you are seeing is that teams are more likely, if you have a player who is a natural opener, who also happens to be the best player in the team. So Hobbs is the best example of this, right? They stay at the top of the order. But if you're the best players in the world are generally not openers, And so I actually think it's a natural selection of cricket because you know that you don't want to send out your best player ever. So I talked to Barry Richards about this very specifically for the book. And I said, why did you open the batting? Because you don't really come across as an opening batter. Like, I mean, Barry Richards definitely comes across as a number three in his era and a number four now, right? So it was really odd to me that he opened the batting. And he said that he played in a team where the openers were terrible. They just kept going out. And I think it was a coach or someone involved with the team just went, just open the batting, right? And then he loved it. And I think that in general, that's probably why you were seeing what you were seeing there. So I don't think the most talented players, I don't think we've actually done them dirty. I think it's a much harder job, and we were as honest as we could be with that job. But when it comes down to it, he has to be in a situation where, as the openers have to be in a situation where a lot of times you will pick openers who are not as good as your 3, 4, and 5 on talent anyway, because you're trying to just get it so that when the 3, 4, and 5 come in, the shine is off the ball is soft, the sun is out, whatever it may be. So I think that's why, Josh, is the overall answer. Applying the same argument to first change bowlers is a case of Ben Stokes to be in the top 50 bowler of all time. I haven't done a start of the bowlers one. Actually, the contract came. I've got to sign it. Only on Wagon Wheel do I remember. I haven't done all my emails. But I'd be shocked if he's the top 50 bowler of all time. And a lot of the guys who are, like, if you think about, I'm just going off the top of my head here. Wagner's a better old ball bowler. Bumrah's a better old ball bowler. McGrath's a better old ball bowler. Steyn's a better old ball bowler, right? In his era. Right? And they're all also masters with the new ball in many occasions, or much better than Stokes with the new ball. So once you start to put all those names together, you'd have to almost make a case for him just being the greatest old ball bowler. Maybe not the greatest. Top 7 old ball bowlers of all time. Is he better than Garner or Akram? I wouldn't have thought so. Right? Like, so we're already slipping him down the order a little bit there. James says, is a leg spinner slider a backspinner, essentially a flipper without the thumb index click, or more akin to a leg cutter with less backspin? It's a slider is a leg spinner where you kind of stop. So it is essentially a leg cutter, but you want it to look like you've still bowled a leg spinner. So, you know, let me get my grip properly. As you come over, I kind of stop there. So the ball still revolves. And I would say a really good batter will pick that my hand hasn't gone all the way through. Although I think my slider is as easy to pick as my wrong end. And very good players, like test players, have missed my slider. No test players ever missed my wrong end, right? So I do think that there's something in the slider that is a little bit more subtle. The way that I always bowled the slider specifically was, I would bowl it so that I'm holding the ball completely cross seam, because I want it more often than not to hit the leather completely. And if I can hit the leather when I do that, it skids through a little bit more and it feels a bit more like a flipper, but it doesn't have the backspin or anything like a flipper. I just want it to look like a leg spinner. I saw Afridi doing this and Kumble doing this. I want it to look like a leg spinner, but for it to go straight. PJ says, if you made your England debut this week, unlikely, PJ, but let's see how this plays out. Who would you punch in the bar after the game? You know, what's fascinating to me is it's stopped now, but there was a period of time where there was a lot of players who were vocal privately, maybe that's the best way of putting it, as vocal as you can be privately, that they thought that there was an issue with the culture and the way that things were going. They loved the baseball of it. They liked the freedom and everything else, but they did feel that, like, they were pushed into drinking more than they wanted to drink, pushed into partying more than they wanted to, and that sometimes some of the crickety things went out. I remember my dad, when I was leaving to move to the UK, and my dad said, I should have pushed you into the army. You know, you obviously needed some structure in your life and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, Have you seen the war films where there's that like weird nerdy guy in the corner that is like no one in the army likes? That would be me. I think I would be the same in the English team. Ajit says, Nitesh Kumar Reddy says he sees himself as a genuine all-rounder rather than a batting all-rounder or bowling all-rounder. In modern ODI cricket, how realistic is it for a player to develop into a true three-dimensional all-rounder like Callis or Stokes? See, I don't – how many overs again did Stokes bowl? I would argue I'd have to have a look at where are we here? I'd have to have a look at Callis's record a little bit more. But I would argue that neither of them were fully fledged all-rounders. Let's just do it. 18. So Stokes didn't bowl in every game, but I'm going to assume some of those are when he was injured. So he bowled 3,000 balls in 88 innings. Yeah. So even at his best, he averaged 35 balls a game. So six overs. So not a frontline bowler. And I'm not going to look up Callis's, but I would assume it's very similar. So the reason that they didn't bowl more overs is, I think in Stokes' case, he wasn't actually a particularly – he was a hard bowler to use because he didn't like the new white ball. He wasn't a particularly good death ball bowler. And so you kind of had to bowl him in the middle, but quite often he was playing – they had two spinners, right, in Rash and Mo. So how do you even get him to his overs if he can't bowl in some of those other places? Also, because of Mo and Ali and sometimes Chris Wokes, they had multiple all-round options. So they didn't even need Stokes to – potentially be that bowler. In Callis's case, I mean, they had Klusner, Pollock, and Callis. McMillan might have overlapped with him a little bit in limited overs cricket as well. They picked spinners who could bat. So again, I don't think they would do it. So you don't actually see many guys who bowl the consistent fifth overs amount. And generally, even when they do, they get injured and they come in and out the team. And so sometimes they play as a specialist batter. I think Pandey has probably done that before. Stokes has definitely done that before. Callis probably did towards the end of his career. So it's actually not that realistic a thing. On top of that, look at India. They've got Washi. They've got Akshar. They've got other potential all-rounders coming through. Like, I'm not sure they really need him to do that thing. But yeah, you know, at your best, what you really want is for him to be able to bat in the top seven and be a bankable 10 overs a game bowler with maybe one other guy that you can use as, you know, that sort of chop out bowler if something's going wrong. I don't think teams really feel comfortable going in knowing they only have 50 overs from five bowlers anymore. So if he can get to seven or eight overs a game, that's more than Stokes. So I think that's fine. Anything over five and a half to six, I think is it probably closer to what you're actually saying, which is more of an all-rounder. But he should be thinking that. Whether he can be that player or not doesn't really matter at this stage, but it's good that he's thinking that. All right, we're going to have a break. And when we come back, there will be more of all of these kinds of things. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. All right. Welcome back to Wagon Wheel. James says, last couple of years, the IPL and the Men's T20 World Cup have come back to back, and I've been sick of T20 cricket by the end of that and not watched as much of the second one as I would have if they'd been separated. Do you know if this is something the ICC are looking at planning to change going ahead? So there's like two major windows. I think the England World Cup windows are slightly different, but there's basically two major windows, right? There's that sort of February to March window, and there's the October-September windows. As I said, it's slightly different in England. But if you look at World Cups globally, they're usually in one of those two windows, and that's what is blanked out on the calendars. The IPL then comes straight after that, so there's not much you can do. I'm kind of with you, James. I think a lot of people complained about the IPL this year. I think part of it was just that we didn't have a lot of close games. And then the second one was that it came on the back of another month of the tournament. I think if there are multiple games a night in the IPL rather than just one, that fixes some of that issue. But yeah, it's going to happen quite consistently, I think, going into the future. The ICC are definitely not going to change that. I don't know what the sort of IPL expansion plans, if they ever have them, in what direction they will go, but I would assume they would take June before they would take, they might take March, yeah. March, April, May, June. So one at each end. But I'm not 100% sure how they will be thinking about it. It's not something that's going to happen straight away, but something to think about. Abe says, a follow-up on my question last time on the most fragile, successful team. Which great team of any era was the most dependent on one player? They were very successful, but a single player solved so many problems that the team's strength may have been overstated. If you remove that player, things will fall apart. I mean, the most obvious one here is New Zealand 1980s. So I think overall in the 1980s, they're probably the third best team, but there were probably times when they were the second best team. I'd have to go back and have a look at it, you know, pound for pound, but I think that's probably fair. If you take Richard Hadlee out of that team, they're not better than Australia. They might be. I'm not sure they're better than England. They're probably still better than Sri Lanka. Not sure they're better than India. So that's quite a dip, right? That's the one off the top of my head. I mean, South Africa, 2008 to 2013, whenever Callis stops bowling, is a team that is probably very, very different without Callis. I don't think they're the behemoth that they ended up being if he's not playing. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. 1930s Australia without Bradman. Very good bowling lineup, but basically two dudes bowling. Good batting lineup, but I don't think they would be the dominant incredible team that they would have been if that had been the case. I suppose there's a period with Sobers, but where they would drop back, but I'm not sure how much. I suppose Imran Khan in the 80s, right? I think if you take Imran Khan out of Pakistan in the 80s, so I had New Zealand go from third to sixth. You take Imran Khan out of that side in the 1980s and you would have their maybe fourth or fifth best team. So from second to fourth. Neil says, PCB just said that 85% of selection decisions will be taken out of selectors' hands and guided by data analytics. Is there Moneyball? Is this their Moneyball moment? And does the internal intelligence framework exist? They literally just cycled through Hassan Chima. I know a little bit about the backstory of this, I think. I was reached out to by a professor in America, I believe. It was quite a while back now. And the PCB, Hassan, I think, was already working for them. But basically, they wanted to professionalize the whole structure of Pakistan cricket. And obviously, data and everything was a big part of it. And myself and the professor, I'm trying to think who the third person was on that call. But there was someone else on that call. And we were, was it Muhammad Khan? No, maybe not. Anyway, I can't remember. Whoever it was that brought us together, but they were involved as well. And he was sort of saying, you know, what can you use data for and everything? And I explained how I would use it and everything. I don't think I would ever use data for 85% of my selection decisions based on data, because I don't think that the data or the way that we collate it or the right information that we're looking for exists in Pakistan at the moment. So you could possibly do that if you had Hawkeye data for all domestic cricketers. Even then, I'd be a little bit hesitant. You've got things like small sample sizes. Like let's say you had a player in Pakistan cricket who is 21. He's just had a big year where he's averaged 47 in first-class cricket, but you don't think he's right at the top of – you think there are other players ahead of him, and that was his first big year. But you go in the data and you see that when the ball was delivered at over 145 kilometers an hour, he was never dismissed. And it could be like 150 balls, right? You then need someone to go back and check and make sure that that wasn't on a wicket where everyone scored 600 runs. I don't think they have any, like, from what I understand of this, that's not really how it's going to be. So I'm very skeptical of doing it. I don't think any cricket team in the world that I know enough about is in the position where they could make 85% of their selection decisions by data, because the data isn't good enough. Not that it can't be, not that we can't learn these things, but at the moment we don't know them. And so if you were making decisions just based on data and cricket, I think you would just make a lot of mistakes. So hopefully they're doing it well, and I'm not saying that professor, but whichever professors and everyone they have involved, but I'd be very skeptical about this working. Mob says, why do England and Wales announce their Test 11 so early? So much more downside. Media, baby! They've got one of the few news-breaking media kind of areas. Even in India, there's a lot of kind of news that is broken in cricket, but it's not specifically about the 11s or anything. It's more about who's unhappy with who and, you know, and that sort of more conversational stuff. But in England, the journalists will go out of their way to find what the 11 is before the game, and they used to break it. And I think the ECB got to a point where they're like, what is the point? We might as well just announce it beforehand. It wasn't broken every time, though. And so the way I would look at it is worth one of the times it was broken. I don't want to say the journalist because it was a really good exclusive. I don't want to have a go at him. But I'm pretty sure someone involved in the team had the team written out and put it on the top of the bin and didn't scrunch it up. And it was just on top of the bin when this guy walked past it. Don't want to out anyone. I mean, good work to look in the bin, I suppose. But yes, if you ask me from an analytics point of view, I've said this for many, many years, it's an absolute terrible decision to tell everyone who is playing beforehand. Ali says, when you meet cricketers, can you tell their socioeconomic background from how they think about the game? No, I don't. Oh, how they think about it. I mean, how they think about the game. It's maybe more prevalent in somewhere like England, where we've seen guys retire from careers who played international cricket really young, who are like, the minute they're not on the verge of playing for England anymore, they will retire at 27, 28, 29. There's been quite a few of those guys. Rory Hamilton-Brown, who was what, the England under 19 captain and Surrey captain. How old would he be now? He's 38, and I don't think he would have played professional cricket. His last game was 2014, so 12 years ago. So he was 26 when he retired. Is that right? So I think in England, maybe a little bit more. Don't think that's really the case in other countries. Maybe from the personality and things they tell you, but I don't think necessarily from how they think about the game. Maybe in some cases on how important the game is to them. Perhaps, but even then, not always. Like, I know some people from really poor backgrounds in cricket who, if they just professionalised themselves and work hard, would have gone on to be really good, and they just didn't seem to care that much, right? And I know just as many posh guys in England who've done the same. So, yeah, I don't think so. Even in England, I think I'd probably say that. Josh says, I had hoped Kane was going to play Test through to 2027 World Test Championship Final and then retire after the ODI World Cup. Was this thinking too wishful? No, I don't think so, Josh. I think once he'd got past the main part of the elbow issue, and Robbie have done a podcast about, you know, tennis elbow and how it affects people. I think once he got past the main part of that injury, there was certainly an element at that point where any flare up again could cause an issue. He's still quite young, right? Like, Is he the youngest of the Fab Four, perhaps? I don't know if it's him or Root, but he has played a lot of cricket. And I think when your body's done, it could be mentally as well, but my guess is that there's a big part of it that's body. There's something in the Sky video that he did with Ian Ward and Stuart Broad, I think, was there as well. Dinesh Karthik? I can't remember. There was a few of them anyway, but it was mostly done by Ian Ward. There's a moment in that, and I've watched that obviously before I wrote my feature, where he bends down to pick up a ball or something and he kind of groans a little bit, very much like an old man. And I remember commentating a game with Peter Saylor, the Dutch captain for TalkSport. And I was commentating this game and Peter Saylor had to like get under a cord or something. Like there was something hanging and he had to get under it. And I watched him do it. And I said on air, he's done. Like his back is gone. If he can't do that without like a level of pain, he's either just injured himself or that's a thing that's gone for a long time. And when I saw the cane thing, similar thing flashed through my head of like, oh, okay. Might be just a physical thing there. But yeah, age-wise, I think, you know, there's nothing in his technique that says he should stop playing Red Bull cricket, right? Like, he's not making runs this week, but do you know what I mean? There's no reason why he couldn't have made runs for another 4 or 5 years with his technique. It's not a technique where you need incredible hand-eye coordination. It's the opposite of that. PJ says, for at least 2 years, I've had Nathan Ellis criminally underrated on my list of wagon wheel questions. What's the deal with him? Why isn't he earning $2 million a year in the IPL, dominating every game? Have I only ever seen him bowl on a good day? Those Death Yorkers are something else. I think the problem with Nathan Ellis as a player is probably that he doesn't dominate the start of the game the same way he does the end. And we don't really pay people what they should get for dominating the ends of games, right? So Bravo and Chris Morris both got paid a lot, but it was also because they could hit sixes. And outside of them, how many death specialist bowlers have actually got paid big wedges of money? So I think there's an element of that. I do think he's good. I do want to see him tested more though as well. But I do think he's good. But I think it's because the feeling is he's not very good with the new ball. He's not a massive plus or a plus with a new ball. Whereas most of your star bowlers are probably on that level. But yeah, I think at the death, he's fantastic. Was it him in the blast game where like he had to bowl the same ball like 3 times in a row because of some sort of nonsense or something? Was that Nathan Ellis? And he's been so good for so long. I remember George Bailey telling me really early on, you need to pay attention to this guy. And like I would message Bales going, what am I missing? Because I didn't see it. And then like one day it just all clicked and I was like, oh, I get it. He gets incredible amount of drop and he nails the Yorker length at a higher rate than anyone else. But he's also very smart the way he thinks through situations. Reece says, are you in the Rob camp on Stokes? Overrated moments cricketer who by all accounts is a shit bloke, or the George Dobell camp who has him as a genuine English great and top bloke? Somewhere in between. Definitely probably somewhere in between those two. They're very extreme, my two friends there. I do think there's a bit of Emperor's New Suit with Stokes at times. I'm in the middle of writing a feature on him. I hope that will explain a little bit more how I see him. I still think we haven't seen many cricketers like him, and I don't really want to. I think we have to remember that he's more than just numbers. I get why Rob Barron has issues with him. I don't know the shit bloke stuff with Rob Barron. I've only met Ben a couple of times. He seems like a very lovely guy when I met him, so I don't have anything there. But there are probably times he has been overrated, but he's also been overrated because he's had those moments. It's not like he's been overrated for no reason. It's because he's done some of the most special things we've ever seen on a cricket field. He's also done a lot of shit on a cricket field too, right? And in Dobell's case, I think he's a genuine English great. I'm not sure off the top of my head if I'd have him in the top 15 cricketers England's ever had, though. Like, I'd have to go through that list. So, I certainly don't have him as a genuine great of the game. But yeah, as far as a bloke, I don't know him pretty well. He's always been really courteous, nice, and seems like... I'll tell you a story about him. So, Andrew McKenna, is a commentator for TalkSport, and our first tour... Macca got a little bit excited in the nets and a ball went up. And Macca hasn't he'd been doing rugby for a long time, but he's a cricketer himself, and the ball went up in the air in the net, so, and so he tried to catch it. Perfectly normal thing to do if you're Macca, right? But, you know, for someone like me who spent a lot of my life around professional nets, I know you can't just sort of dip in and dip out. The ball is hit a lot higher than you will get in a club game, and it's going to really come down. But Macca isn't thinking that. He's just thinking, if this wasn't my nets, I'd go and catch it. So he goes to try and catch it, and the ball just absolutely disintegrates his ring finger. Is that the ring finger? I never know which fingers are for what, but this one, the one that's not little, but is little-ish. And like the noise it made is one of the worst injury noises I've ever heard. And that finger was purple for ages. Like Macca should have got it fixed and didn't. That's on him. But I remember Ben coming over straight away to ask if he was all right. And it wasn't, I thought it was Ben who hit the ball. But it wasn't. Apparently, it was someone else. I think it might have been Rashid who hit the ball, or someone else hit the ball anyway. And I think that, you know, for me, it's little things like that. Does he get angry? Does he have other issues? Obviously. But I don't think I think he probably has an issue when he gets angry. I think he, you know, clearly puts himself into situations he doesn't need to be in. No issue there. But I'm not sure I've seen anything that makes me think he's a terrible person. Right? There aren't that many people in cricket that I think are terrible people. I've got a list, though. James says, does the 12 players aside in the IPL have an opportunity to bring back specialist wicketkeepers? No. So someone asked me about this recently, James. I think we'd have to get to 14 or 15 to get back. I think if we got back to that, I think specialist wicketkeepers or specialist fielders are a definite chance in cricket. Abe said, you said on a recent video with Rob Deepak and Robbie that you rate Williamson higher than Martin Crowe on the list of New Zealand all-time greats. Can you say more on why? I wasn't alive during Crowe's era, but always thought he was easily considered the best batter New Zealand produced, although admittedly, Williamson is the better test captain. I'm not sure Williamson is the better test captain, babe. I just think that Martin Crowe didn't have a very good bowling lineup. I think Martin Crowe was a very good captain, but yeah, by the time he had taken over, the team was probably slightly on the decline from their peak. Williamson has a much higher average. I think he averages about 9 or 10 more. Some of that is era, because Martin Crowe played in a particularly tough era. It's not just era, though. You look at match factor, he has a much better average. Specifically, when Kane Williamson made runs, New Zealand win a lot. Kane Williamson has one of the highest batting averages ever in the history of the game in wins and draws. Is it the highest since World War II? I can't even remember now. Bunch of records like that. Another one is home record as well. Absolutely brilliant. I had him at number 32 in the art of batting, and I have Crowe at 40. I'm pretty sure about that because I just wrote the piece on it. I compared them in the piece because I think it's a fair thing to do. I truly believe that Martin Crowe had his knees not gone so early when he was young. I think his knees start to go when he's 28, 29. I honestly believe that if his knees hadn't gone around that age, that by the age of 36 or 37, we might have seen the best of Martin Crowe. Because I think he was perhaps one of the... I think he was like a Tendulkar-level thinker about batting. And one of the best technicians we've seen as well. And also he had the ability, like Kumar or Sachin, to change the way he was playing based on conditions on that day and nail them. So I think we missed out on probably Martin Crowe having a big 3 or 4 years. If he has those big 3 or 4 years, I think he has a genuine chance to go past Williamson. Without them, I kind of feel like Williamson has had the better career. The one thing that brings Crowe back is that the best bowling attacks he went up against were West Indies, Pakistan, Australia and South Africa. He doesn't play against South Africa that much. The Australia he went up against were not particularly good. He averaged something like 60 against Pakistan in the peak of their reverse swing era. And I think he averages high 40s against the great West Indian attack. And he faced both West Indian attacks, right? He faced the first generation and the second generation. He faced the crossover generation as well. So against the best bowling attacks, I think Martin Crowe probably showed his worth. I absolutely loved him as a player. I don't think he had a better test career than Kane Williamson. I think if you want to say who was the better bat, I think that's a more interesting question. But specifically, when we're looking at the art of batting, we're factoring all those things in. And I think that Williamson deserves to be where he is in that. All right. I don't think we have any super chats, he says. I can't see any at the moment. But let me just go through. In fact, I'll just play a quick ad and just see if there's anything in the normal chat. And then we will wrap up this here wagon wheel. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. There's a bunch of Discord ones. I'm just trying to get. Oh, Paul just said that Root is the youngest. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure. I know they were roughly the same age. It's surprising to me that he's gone. But it's also a reminder, like, we're starting to get used to people playing a little bit later, but sometimes your body just doesn't allow it, right? Like, you got to be realistic. These things are, it's kind of how they go. Anyway, we'll get to, I've got a bunch here. I'll just quickly rattle through these. Ringo says, what do you think about the PCB format-wise central contracts? Do you think more boards will follow the same? Yeah, I kind of think that this is overdue. I mean, boards kind of factor it in already. As in, they know that some people are just going to play, so you just pay them less. But yeah, I think it probably needed to be a little bit more formalized. I don't know if Pakistan's the first team to have done it, but certainly it's something that's probably a little bit overdue. Hypercore says, if Williamson played for Australia or England, he'd also play a lot more games against Australia, where he averaged 36.95. And England, 40.9. Well, he wouldn't play against England at all, Hypercore. And India, 37.86. Yeah, it would change. Having said that, though, it would be a completely different situation for him to play in those games. If you run back his career, like, this, there's no real butterfly effect that we can do from that. But there's no doubt he would have made 2,000 or 3,000 more runs if he had played for one of the bigger teams, just because he would have played more games, even if his average dropped. Paul just says, would you have Stokes having a better career than Flintoff? Yeah, I think so. I didn't know I started this one. This is an interesting question. Yes, I think I do. Flintoff has a couple of years that are ridiculous. But if you look at Flintoff's record, he has Flintoff and Chris Martin both bowl in a very batter dominated era. And neither of them are particularly good at taking tail end wickets. And so I think their averages are higher than they should be with the ball. But for as good as Flintoff was with the ball, his average doesn't really make sense to me. I think he should have had a much better record than that. And I think he probably had a couple of really good years with the bat, but I'd have to go through it. But yes, I think I would take Stokes over Flintoff. But I suppose it also depends on what kind of cricketer you're looking for. Like, in a team, there might be situations where you'd prefer to have, if I can have Flintoff as my fifth bowler batting at number six, and he's batting good enough to deserve to be in that spot, I'd rather have him in that spot than Stokes in that spot. But Flintoff cannot bat at five, right? Even in a pinch. Like, six is probably a bit of a pinch for him. Susha says, why is it that form in cricket matters more than other sport? Why is it that form in cricket matters far more than other sports? For example, the Spurs didn't bench De'Aaron Fox despite his form being in question. Does it have something to do with culture? It actually has something to do with benching. So in a normal sport, you can have a game with De'Aaron Fox where you change his minutes around a little bit, right? So he's got a bad matchup in that game. He's got a bit of a hamstring niggle. You have the ability to be able to say, okay, well, we're not going to play through him in this game. You can't really do that with batting and bowling. You have to play through the player. And you can't, like, bring them off the bench or rest them more on the bench, right? And so what happens with form is, let's take Suryakumar. Is he the best one I want to do this with? Yeah, let's take Surya Kumar Yadav. Let's forget him as a captain for a moment with the Indian team. Let's imagine he's going to get dropped from the next Indian international game. I'm not saying he is, but just for this thought experiment to work, makes sense. His overall numbers in the last year are not enough for him to be dropped, but there might be better players coming through and everything else. But you would be silly if you were a professional sporting organization in another sport to get rid of him rather than either restrict his minutes or put him on the bench or bring him on during softer matchups, whatever you have to do to get him going. We don't really have that as a career option in cricket. Because if you're in the lineup, you have to be performing your maximum pretty much all the time. It's very hard to carry a player in a lineup. No other sport has this. You can have an aging striker who you still know is really, really skillful, who just needs to play the last 30 minutes of a game quite regularly. And we don't have that in cricket because of the structure of the sport. So I think that plays a part of it. The other thing is, in basketball, De'Aaron Fox, by the time he's playing for the Spurs, he will have played, 105 games of the year if he's not injured, right? Over that period of time, they know that his form is going to go up and down and up and down and up and down. No one does that in cricket, right? You don't play that many games and you go weeks and months without playing. And so we don't get the same kind of form baseline. So it's built into cricket for us to think more about form than any other sport. Asia Fratboy says, I proposed about 3 years ago the next Fab Four would be Gil, Brook, Ratchan Ravindra, and Abdullah Shafiq. I think I'm right on 2.5 of them. So the way I put this is, and everyone was looking for the next Fab Four. They even remember there was a period where Baba was making lots of runs, and it was like, can we put Baba in the Fab Four? And I was like, no, it doesn't fit the age curve. We, in the whole history of the game, have never had four players of roughly the same age, of roughly the same level of great talent that overlaps with and the same skill sets at the same time. We might never have another Fab Four. We don't need to look for another Fab Four. If it happens, it happens naturally. By the way, was it Martin Crowe who came up with the term? I think it might have been. But yeah, so I'm not worried about that. As far as whether you're right, I've got no issues with Gil. I think Brook will be fantastic. I'm not sure he's going to be the best player in the world in 6 years' time, though, or 5 years' time. I mean, he could be, but Ratchan Ravindra, I think there's genuine question marks over, but I still think he's fantastic. And Abdullah Shafiq, what's his age? Is really what I want to ask you. Where is he? He's 26. I wouldn't be writing Abdullah Shafiq off, because he's played 24 test matches and he's 26. So he should be about to hit his peak batting years. So in a tough era, he's averaging high 30s. What's the biggest question mark for him? He's actually not made enough runs at home, is the biggest one. So that's even a little bit away. He's averaged 45 away from home and 33 at home. Where are those away tests? Consistent runs in Bangladesh, consistent runs in Pakistan. In Sri Lanka. And a bit up and down in Australia. I wouldn't throw him out, which is probably the best way I would put him. Amit Rana says, you put him over Shane Bond. I'm going to assume that he means as the second greatest cricketer for New Zealand, and he means Kane Williamson. I don't have Shane Bond in my top three greatest New Zealand cricketers, partly just because he didn't play that long, right? He just doesn't play that many games. What's his total? 250 international wickets spread across three formats. He played 18 test matches. Fantastic record. But he averages less in test cricket than he does in first class cricket. He could have just been in really good form, picked at the right time in test cricket. ODI numbers, he was generally going to be a great there. I have no issues on that. It could have been a great in test cricket as well, but I think there's more questions there. T20 cricket looks pretty good as well from what he played in T20 cricket. Plays another 5 years. What is this? It's an 8-year career, and really it's probably more of a 6 to 7. Oh, wait, that's test cricket. Yeah. Probably more of a 6 to 7 year career, right? You can't be this. I mean, there's heaps of great players if you go back. What's the guy's name? Stewie Dempster plays 10 test matches for New Zealand and averages 65, right? Bond's played 8 more test matches than him. We can throw in the white ball stuff as well. You're not getting past Kane Williamson's career or Martin Crowe's career. Maybe Glenn Turner's. I'm not sure you get past Vettori or Chris Cairns' career either. Obviously, it's a shame because he could have been their second greatest cricketer, but I don't think he was. All right, that's me done for another Wagon Wheel. There's a bunch of Kimappas. We did a live one earlier today on Trey Asiah. We've got another one on Kane Williamson, another one on Ben Stokes, and we've got heaps more content. We've recorded so much content. We're recording so much more. Really loving the way the Combox is coming together, where we can just be like, let's go. Oh, all the Women's World Cup stuff. I don't even think I've been on a show yet for the Women's World Cup. So I'll definitely be popping into some of those as well. But anyway, that's the end of Wagon Wheel here, and we'll be back very soon for more of this kind of thing, which is people talking into microphones. That's how we like it. It got a bit ASMR, didn't it? I didn't mean for that. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.